and welcome back to Daleks Aren't Robots. I am Josh the Tired, and as always, I am here with my friends, my Whovian fact checker friend Zach.
Hello.
And our non-Whovian PR meme lion co-producer does half the stuff friend Kari.
Hello.
Sadly, our other non-Whovian Justin is still not able to join us. We're hoping to get him back for next episode, but you never know. Anyway, as always, Zach and I are taking our non-Whovian buddy on a tour through all of Doctor Who, starting from the beginning. And today's episode is The Sensorites.
Ooh.
Which was very fun to watch with Kari, let me tell you. So, Kari, can you sum up what this episode was about?
Yes, I can. I will do my best. Okay, so we just got done with the Aztecs. The crew finds some dead human astronauts from Earth in the future in their own little spaceship. The astronauts turn out not to be dead. Instead, they're being mentally affected or mind-controlled by these aliens called the Sensorites. Some weird stuff happens, and then the dumbest-looking aliens ever to exist in the history of the universe show up. They are the Sensorites, and they look like an alien from Mac and Me banged a duffel pud from the Narnia books, and I freaking died laughing. Like, we had to take a break for like 10 minutes.
Yep.
At this point. Eventually, I wiped the tears off my eyes and got a snack, and we started the show again. And then I saw that they were wearing footy pajamas, and I died laughing again. And we had to stop.
They were kind of dressed like Dr. Seuss characters.
Absolutely like Dr. Seuss characters. They even had the inappropriately placed hair. I could not stop laughing for the longest.
Imagine if it had been in color and you'd seen that they were wearing blue.
Oh my God,
yeah,
yes.
They're baby
blue. I mean, I cannot express how literally these are footy pajamas, you guys. Like, they are so footy pajamas. And the way that the alien just pops up into the window at first, I could not stop laughing.
No.
So funny. Exactly. It was the most inappropriately funny thing I think I've ever seen in my life. Anyway, so eventually we started watching it again.
Anyway, that's part one of this six-part serial.
Yeah, that was part one. Anyway, it turns out that the Sensorites aren't bad people. They're afraid of humans. And it turns out that one of the astronauts had discovered their planet was made from a valuable mineral, molybdenum, and that's why they're afraid of the humans. They're afraid that the humans will come and, like, strip mine their whole planet. Eventually, everyone but Barbara ends out hanging out with the Sensorites on their home planet. And the Sensorites have a problem where a lot of them are dying for no obvious reason. This is a problem which started for them when a group of humans arrived 10 years ago. Eventually, Barbara comes down and sorts everything out, and it turns out some humans who were crazy due to the Sensorite mind control were poisoning them, and a Sensorite city administrator trying to murder our team and absolutely murdering other Sensorites is caught off-screen in the largest anti-climax since the final book in the Twilight series.
Yeah, like, the main bad guy for most of the serial basically gets shoved to the side for a completely unrelated climax with the crazed human, and then is just, like, settled in a bit of exposition.
Yeah, it's super bizarre. Like, maybe he was on vacation or something, and they couldn't get him back. I don't know.
I think it was more they ran out of time.
I mean, maybe. But then why did they have all the padding that they... I don't know.
The last episode was rather rushed.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Okay, so we will, of course, go through this bit by bit. But before that, Kari, question. On a scale from Marco Polo to the Aztecs, how would you rank this serial?
I would rank it below the Aztecs, but still pretty far up there. There's a lot of good character moments for everyone. The plot is fairly engaging. The pacing is mostly okay. I feel like they could have made it shorter. Honestly, if Barbara had been there the whole time, it would have been a two-parter.
Yeah.
Because, like, as soon as she comes down, everything is, like, completely solved.
The second half, I think the pacing is fine. It's the first half that's the big problem. Those first three episodes drag a lot.
It drags a little bit at first, especially with the astronauts, because I don't care about them that much and they're not that interesting.
I think after like halfway through, they don't show up again.
Yeah, they really don't. It's sort of an odd five-part episode almost.
Okay, so let's start off with our
we need to talk about the sensorites, man.
It is a very interesting design.
Interesting. Interesting.
We didn't even get into the fact that they have flapjack feet.
Oh my god. Well, that's where the duffel puds come from. They have plate-like feet and they wear soft baby blue footy pajamas. And of course, these episodes are in black and white, but those are definitely baby blue, and I've seen pictures.
Yeah,
and
we've
it's even funnier.
We've seen the production photos, yeah.
Yes. And they have like an upside-down wig glued to their chins. And at the end of the episode, by that point, obviously in production, like the wigs were starting to fall off and it really, really showed. And that's not even mentioning the caterpillar fur glued around their eyes. I mean, they look like paper mache things that your 3-year-old would create and bring home from preschool. And you'd have to talk about how great it is, having no idea what it's even supposed to be.
Okay, Zach, I can feel you wanting
it's going a little into production, but so one, the feet, just starting there, we'll get to the head. The feet,
we'll work our way up.
We're doing the auditory equivalent of a pedestal shot.
Yeah, we are. We totally are.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The feet, they did that on purpose. Now, I can't find exactly why they decided to do it. And actually, the actors could barely move with them. In fact, if you notice, after we get off the spaceship, we never really see them from the waist down, the sensorites, because they stopped doing the feet in a lot of the shots so that they could actually move the sensorites.
From what you told me, that the plates they were putting in the feet to give them that circular thing were actually cutting through the onesie.
Yes, at points, yeah. So they had to repair it.
Oh, no.
I think my favorite thing about that, though, is you saying, I can't find why they decided to do this. That is a sentence that you just love hearing.
I'll get into reasons for that once we get to production. But now to the masks, which, first of all, this is a return of the amazing costume designer, Daphne Dare, who was the costume designer for all the sci-fi episodes at this time, working with Raymond Cusick, who was the set designer for all the sci-fi things.
Which, of course, includes Key of Marinus and those now famous brain slugs. So yes. This is that guy. This is brain slug guy.
But Daphne Dare is also the one who came up with the Vord outfit. And so the masks were designed for shorter actors. So the masks from the start were more stretched than they should have been.
Which
the
just idea, raises several questions.
The idea behind the look is they were supposed to look like wise old men.
Well, they definitely look old.
I think this cast might kill Kari.
Have they ever seen an old man?
And the reason that the beards, the caterpillars to the chin, were coming off is because the mouth flap was directly under that beard.
Oh.
So they weren't supposed to be beards. They were supposed to be mutton chops.
No, they were supposed to be beards.
Oh, okay. They just
upside
they were
down
too small.
Beards. Oh, my gosh. No.
It's like one of those pictures where if you turn it one way, it's a young man. You turn it the other way, it's an old man.
Except it's old both ways.
Yeah.
Also, it's just a hot mess. Whichever way you turn the paper, this is going to be a hot mess.
There is one thing about the sensorite design that I absolutely need to mention because it will break Kari.
No. Okay, lay it on me.
When they brought the show back in 2005, that design went on to inspire an alien that they brought in the David Tennant era.
No.
Modern day costume designers looked at that and said, yes, we need to steal this. They became inspiration for, and fans will recognize this name, the Ood, which are a race of psychic, they're sort of a servant race.
You have a picture ready to show her?
I can have a picture.
Oh, dear. I just, they're so, and they're so non-threatening. They're like utterly non-threatening. I burst into peals and peals of laughter the second they showed up. And like at no point in any of these episodes are they even slightly threatening. And like the plot goes even further to make them less threatening. They can't stand loud noise. They can't even stand loud thoughts. They can't see in any kind of dim light. So like if you have a dimmer switch, you can make them cry. They don't move very fast. And of course, now we know why, because they couldn't, their little foot plate things didn't work very well. And they're scared of humans, and these are the least scary aliens to have ever existed in the history of eternity.
Okay, so I've just shared a picture of an Ood to you.
Oh my. Well, yeah, that's at least got the tentacles, because the tentacles make it a little disturbing.
It's definitely better.
It's a lot better. The upside down beards were just terrible. Oh, and let's mention one more thing with their design. They can do some like telepathy stuff, but only with the aid of a stethoscope thing. And they hold it up to their foreheads, which is just even funnier. Like,
kind of adorable, actually.
It's hilarious. It is hilarious. I just can't even with the sensorites. They are so funny.
Okay, we have now gone off on that design for a while. Let's talk about some of the side characters.
The astronauts, Carol, John, and Maitland. Maitland is his last name. I can't remember his first name. Maitland exists to be thoroughly English, like as English as humanly possible. He probably sweats black tea. He probably owns an alarm clock that plays the Big Ben chimes and says like, pip, pip, cheerio, I say, oh, chap, for like all the time. That's his entire character. He's just like maximally English.
That is,
to be fair, John gets there himself.
John does get there when he recovers. He gets there.
But we'll get to that.
Maitland is definitely a man who back home has a bowler hat and umbrella collection.
Oh, he's definitely wearing Union Jack underpants. Anyway, Carol is the official the girl. She's a little bit smarter than most of the girls, and she's more resistant to mind control than Maitland is, which is kind of nice. John is her mandatory love interest. When we meet him, he is crazy, crazy, crazy due to the sensorite's mind control, and he is like the biggest ham. Like, I feel like he went to acting school with Brian Blessed or something. And he's super fun to watch until his mental issues are solved. And then he becomes about half as English as Maitland and only about twice as interesting. In other words, he's super boring.
He's very dull.
And we've also seen the actor, well, haven't seen, but heard the actor before. He was our villain in Keys of Marinus.
Yes, he was the lead Vord.
Yeah, I don't know if that counts as a villain or just a comically inept antagonist. I don't know.
It was certainly a performance, though.
In a way, but like we never,
he even comes back in later serials, so we can
good. I hope he's crazy in those too, because he was a lot of fun when he was crazy. He just chewed scenery and had a great old time.
I concur.
There are also a few sensorites that have personalities. The first elder is super compassionate. He's really gentle. He's cautious, but he's very capable of trusting people. The second elder is more willing to believe that humans are bad, but he's also willing to try making peace. The city administrator is the baddie. He's less powerful than either of those other guys. He ends up murdering the second elder. There are also other sensorites. Like, there's a scientist guy who helps the doctor figure out what's killing them.
The city administrator has, like, some toady character.
Yeah, he has, like, a flunky.
Yeah.
That's about
First warrior.
First warrior, okay.
I just called him the city administrator's flunky.
Yeah, I just realized it's the same dynamic as the bad guys from the Aztecs.
Absolutely.
And It's the formula we're going to see a lot.
Except not as good, because sadly, First Warrior Guy is not nearly as compelling as Ixta.
No, he isn't. He's just not that important.
I will just give them this. The fact that they are showing an alien species, at least they're showing them as having different personalities. They aren't all the same exact copies.
Yeah, it's like...
They're quite different from each other.
I will also say, just as a point for the audience, who we can't assume has seen the serial, sadly, we're not forgetting their names by calling them by their titles. They do not have names. The idea of Sensorite culture is that you are only ever referred to by your title, and everyone's title is like a different class.
I'll get into a reason for that later.
Well, we can talk about that now if you want. I feel like they wanted to make this serial more of a commentary on ambition, but even more so on the way that caste systems destroy social mobility and lead to destructive behavior on the part of people who can't get ahead due to their caste. The commentary, if that's what they were trying to do, though, I don't think it really worked. It wasn't brought into the light enough. That's my opinion. But you can tell me, you know, what is behind the Sensorites? Like, what's the deal?
There's two things. The first thing that I'll go into is the writer, Peter R. Newman, based a lot of the serial on his, a lot of the inspiration on his time as a prisoner of war in Japanese camps.
Oh.
And that's where the idea of the humans at the end who think that there's a war still going on, a lot of that comes from his time as a prisoner of war.
Okay.
I also have to imagine that some of John comes from that as well.
Oh, yeah. Sure. That would make sense.
But there is, of course, another inspiration for Sensorite culture.
Yes, which is Maoist Communist China, which for me watching it, knowing a lot of that, the racial attitudes really were uncomfortable. The fact that even they couldn't tell each other apart.
Yeah. That's super racist, isn't it?
Also, they make explicit mention of them having darkened eyes versus everyone else, and they're kind of slant-eyed in the costume.
And they're afraid of everything. Meek and mild. Oh dear, this is super racist.
The First Elder talks mainly in, you know, shortened wisdom.
Oh yeah. Oh dear. Wow, somehow this manages to be more racist than Marco Polo.
Yeah. And that's subtle, which is
we didn't know the history of it, I wouldn't know what they were about.
You guys both missed it. So
yeah,
I guess we're not racist enough, guys. Oh dear. Hi, that's too bad. Jeez. Okay, now I feel bad for even liking this a little bit, but yikes. Okay.
I mean,
there is that.
Yeah.
Maybe we should move on.
Yes.
Let's go back to talking about this show. As far as our characters go, finally we got a good episode for Susan again.
Yes.
And she turns out to have some capability for telepathy. And so she's able to communicate with the Sensorites with her mind. Woo-hoo.
Yeah, this is our first indication that Time Lords and Time Ladies have sort of latent telepathic powers.
And it makes a huge difference because she's able to get them to trust her a little bit because of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it kind of gives them a way in and helps them not just like abduct everyone and treat them badly. Really.
And at the end, she's helping guide a rescue operation. So,
yeah.
A little bit, yeah.
She's cool. But I do have to note, she's got some good character building and some conflict with the doctor, too. Mm. She has an argument with him. Apparently, they say for the first time ever, which I also find super hard to believe because he's super pugnacious and Susan is not, shrinking violet by any means. But okay, whatever.
I mean, you got to take everything that the doctor says with a grain of salt.
Yeah, exactly. I'm thinking they had arguments, but he won, so he probably doesn't consider it an argument.
Yeah.
Or at least he thinks he won, so.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so Susan had some really good moments in this. Barbara does too. If she had been around the whole time, this seriously would have been a two-parter.
Barbara's the best.
Yeah, she shows up and like solves everything except the poisoning issue. And so I just feel like we should rename this show Barbara Solves Everything. Because she needs to be gone for there to be a plot, you guys. I don't know about that.
I will say, watching this, even though there's a little bit of conflict with Susan and the doctor, it isn't so much resolved as it is just kind of dropped.
Right. It's pushed to the side.
Yeah. Like at the end, they have a little bit of a chat, and I guess that's them reconciling, but like it's not really related. It's more a discussion of like what Susan wants going forward.
Right.
Which in a weird way was kind of sad, knowing how Susan's character ends up. But
yeah,
I think that's jumping a little too far ahead.
Also, can we just mention that Ian looks like Steve Jobs this whole episode?
He does rock the black turtleneck.
He is so Steve Jobsy, and it's odd because he's trying to be this protective guy again. Like, he's not too insufferable in this one, even though he's still protective. And it always makes me laugh now when he's overprotective of Barbara, because she can beat him up.
Yes.
Like, she has beat him up.
He also spends at least a whole episode in bed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the black turtleneck is funny too. I don't know.
Susan and the doctor, I feel, the ones who really kind of walk away with the show here.
Yeah.
Side characters are all fine, but I don't think any of them have really stood out in the way some past ones have. There isn't an Ixta or a Ping Cho or anything. There's no one who I'm like.
The doctor has some good points too, though, in this one. He, like you said, he does some science in this episode, and he's the one that figures out that the Sensorites did not, in fact, catch a disease from the humans. They are being poisoned, and they are being poisoned by atropine or belladonna. One point on this, when I remembered this, I kind of got confused, because for some reason they don't mention that belladonna affects your eyes. It like forces your pupils to dilate, and so they let in all of the light, and so it makes you super sensitive to light. The Sensorites' whole thing is that they're afraid of the dark because they can't see in the dark. So once they're sensitive to light and they can't see in the dark, like, you'd think that that would be a plot point, I guess, because they talked about their eyes so much.
Or potentially the writer didn't know that's what belladonna did.
Everybody knows that. Everybody knows that. No, seriously, everybody knows that, because belladonna means beautiful lady, and like they used to use belladonna to dilate the pupils on purpose for cosmetic effect. So like, if you know anything about belladonna, you're gonna know that.
It's also possible that it was originally going to be a plot point and then got dropped for whatever reason.
Yeah, that could be it.
And also, assuming Peter R. Newman knew anything like that is a big assumption.
Well, that's true, but it's notable because it could have been any poison, you know?
Possible.
There are a lot of naturally occurring poisons.
Yes.
Anyway, I just thought it was odd looking back on it that they chose that, because you'd think that it would be employed as a plot device.
Yeah, you would. I don't know.
But the sciencing was cool. The doctor did some sciencing. That was nice.
I personally always really like it when the doctor gets to be like sort of sciencey or crafty or have like a project. A lot of doctors surprisingly don't get that very much. They, you know, just see something and know what's going on because they're just that smart, or like it's more of a detective thing. But the doctor is ultimately a scientist. He is a character who looks into things.
Yeah.
Well, he definitely did here. And I thought it provided some nice character moments too.
Yeah.
And he does do some action doctor stuff as well, and goes down to the sewers and gets his coat removed.
I also did
the death of the coat.
The coat died. I was sad.
Coat dies. Now he will have a cloak for the...
I do like the cloak, but I like the coat better.
I don't think the cloak fits his style as well. At least not this doctor. Later doctors, maybe. I also really like the bit where the doctor's basically threatening the Sensorites. We don't see that a lot from the doctor, frankly.
I don't even think he meant to. Well, he did mean to at one point, but there was another point where he was just yelling at them. It was either the yelling or just thinking at them so loud that they cringe.
Yeah, but no, I'm referring to the specific point on the ship where he's using a veiled threat.
Yes.
And it's very nice. This doctor, I feel, has become very protective of his people, which I like.
Yeah, I don't know if that's because like he's protective of them as people, or if he's just started thinking of them as pets.
I mean,
I think he thinks Barbara's people. I'm not sure about Ian.
Well, yeah, at the end, he was pissed at Ian again, so...
Yeah, and it was like, all is right with the world, the men aren't agreeing again. I think he thinks of Ian as kind of a disobedient dog sometimes.
Or a disobedient child.
Yeah, maybe. Except he treats Susan better than that, so I don't think so.
Maybe.
I would definitely say dog.
I feel he definitely has a respect for Barbara, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
He's developed that, yeah.
Which, I mean, like, how can you not? Barbara is queen.
Yes. She saves the day so much. I did like the sets in this episode, especially the astronaut's ship at the beginning. They start out kind of in a control room with lots of dials and stuff, but their whole ship has kind of an industrial look to it with stripy walls that give it kind of a lot of texture. They just make it look more mechanical. There's a lot of dials on the wall and doodads and stuff. It was clear that they had super limited sets for their spaceship. But the nice thing was then when you went down to the Sensorites planet, everything was super open and light in color, and the textures were all very soft, like the hoodie pajamas.
Yeah. The spaceship sets, Raymond Cusack used 1940s Dakota military aircraft as his...
Oh, okay. Yep. I can definitely see that.
And then for the Sensorite City, he decided there would be no right or straight angles. It would be all curves.
Yes, all of the portals are curved. There's not a lot of texture. Everything looks super soft and like hoodie pajamas in architectural form.
He used a Spanish artist, Antoni Gaudí, as his inspiration.
Oh,
I can kind of see it, weirdly.
Yeah, definitely.
Something about the architecture does feel very, like, Spain.
Nice.
I will say, even though it comes from a place of racism and backwards thinking, unfortunately, I actually really like the Sensorite society. I wish they kind of had gone back to the planet and done more stories there, because I feel like it's an interesting caste system that could have been worth exploring.
That and the fact that they're all men.
Yeah, we don't see any Sensorite ladies.
We never see any Sensorite women. And there are family groups. And that is what they call them, family groups. Yes. And they are protective of their family groups. Like, when someone's family group is threatened, they go along with whatever they're being made to do.
Yes, when they have a chance, they attack the threatener with wild abandon, which we don't actually... Like, the Sensorites seem like a very non-violent species.
Right. Yep, absolutely.
So aside from their ridiculous design, I'm sad that we don't see them again.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so we've covered pretty much all the characters. We've covered, I feel, the main crux of the story. We didn't really get into the prisoners under the city, unfortunately, and I feel like that's kind of because the serial doesn't really get into them all that much.
No, they just show up, and at first it's not totally clear what their deal is. And it turns out that there were 5 humans that arrived at the Sensorite homeworld. 2 of them escaped on the ship, and the other 3 disappeared. And the Sensorites clearly thought that they had been blown up when the ship blew up with the 2 humans in it. However, they actually just ran into like the sewers or whatever and have been hiding there ever since. But I guess like the mental radiation of the Sensorites made them crazy.
Well, it also seems like greed made them crazy a little bit, because the main guy's ranting about like what they're going to do when they get all of that unobtainium that's at the center of the planet and
molybdenum. And also molybdenum, like,
it's a real thing.
Right, that's a real
element. Oh, it is? Oh, I didn't know that.
That's a real element. Oh. Of course it is, Josh. My goodness. Did you not take chemistry?
I am not a science nerd.
Okay, am I the only one who knows? Okay, I'm the only one who knows about poison. I'm the only one that knows about molybdenum.
About molybdenum.
Yeah, but you couldn't say it.
Yeah, at
to be fair, neither can anyone else.
I am a sci-fi nerd. I am not a science nerd.
But like, Josh, come on. Chemistry class.
I haven't listened to the Tom Lehrer Elements song in a while, okay? I'm sorry.
Fair enough. There are some nice things with that too, I thought.
Yeah, it's all in the second half of the final episode.
It's very rushed.
And given that the first 3 episodes are padded out to the max, you're kind of like, why didn't we do less on the ship and put more towards this stuff?
Yeah, especially since the astronauts are kind of boring. Like, they're not as interesting as three crazy guys living in a sewer.
Except John, and he's
And then they cured him and made him boring.
Yeah, he's only interesting when he is crazy.
There are some nice hints about the Earth of the future when the human astronauts show up. Like, there's not a London anymore. It's all Central City now, whatever that means.
We learn about, I forget what they call it instead of Central London, or like...
No, it's not London. It's all Central City.
Central City, right, right.
Do they keep any of that stuff, or is that all tossed out later?
Most of that is tossed. Future Earth changes a lot depending on what story we're talking about.
To be totally fair, we have no idea what the time frame for that is.
This is, I think they said, the 28th century
is
the one they're from.
What, 28th from what?
I feel like they kept the 80, I think.
Oh, okay.
Doctor Who doesn't really play that, unfortunately.
That doesn't make any sense, because why on earth would we assume that that would be the case?
Yeah.
Most of the stuff that I can really remember, like, becoming a big continuity thing is from the 51st century. Doctor Who gets really into the 51st century for a little while.
We do get some hints about the Doctor and Susan's homeworld.
Yes, this is our first description of Gallifrey, which has actually stuck through the show.
Orange skies at night and silver leaves on the trees.
Yeah, yes. That has actually now become orange skies just all the time.
Really?
Yeah, we apparently never see Gallifrey during the day. Anytime we've been in an outdoor shot on Gallifrey, it's orange skies.
Yep. Huh, fair enough. Okay. Are there two suns? I mean, that'd be a good reason that it's never, you know, well, that'd be
you
the
never
opposite,
really see but... a shot of the sky enough to see how many.
Maybe it's night all the time. Maybe it's day all the time. Maybe it's like, you know.
And I don't think we're ever outside in the classic series, so.
Not really. No, they didn't have the budget for that. But we've seen Gallifrey's landscape outside of windows and stuff.
Yeah.
Cool.
The matte paintings of Gallifrey.
Yes. I forgot to ask about the egg beater guns. Like, the Sensorites have these really cool looking guns that look like one of those old style coiled egg beaters. Like, I don't know if you know the ones that I'm talking about, but they're not like normal egg beaters now. They're like all one piece and in a coil. So I'm just wondering, like, if somebody in the props department had a fear of kitchen implements? Between the Dalek egg beaters and these egg beaters that also kind of look like pie crust thingies, I don't know what's going on, but, like, does this person scream whenever they open their kitchen drawer?
I think maybe it's just those are really cheap to get.
Actually, I don't know if they're scared of the kitchen, but parts of the Daleks and these guns were designed and made not by the BBC. They were made by a separate company called Shawcraft Models.
Oh my gosh, they outsourced the whisks?
And other famous things that Shawcraft would be known for would be various props for James Bond films and the car from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Oh!
I assume the Dick Van Dyke movie.
Yeah.
Yes,
Not like, I don't know, I mean, there's the book first, so God only knows how many stuff they could have made, but yeah, that's cool.
Wow.
But yeah, they designed the kitchen egg beater guns.
Oh my gosh. That's cool. Well, they looked really nice. And they required no special effects, which I'm sure was half the point.
Yeah, a lot of early Doctor Who weapons require no special effects. Yeah, so Zach, any interesting behind-the-scenes stories?
I seem to tell this story a lot, but this is another case where the show almost got canceled.
No. Why? Why did the show almost get canceled? Okay, so they've almost been canceled because of the budget. They've almost been canceled because, like, why have they almost been canceled before?
Oh, before?
So before this, it was the budget, and then what else was there? The scissors thing? Was it the scissors thing? I can't remember.
Susan almost cut the show off.
Yeah. I mean, come on, Ian.
It was the budget, and I believe there was also, I think it was ratings maybe, but I could be wrong.
Daleks, the ratings were not very good. So I can imagine after the first serial, they're like, welp.
Okay. No much. All right. For that. So we've had the budget. We've had the ratings. Now what is it?
While they were trying to get the space and everything to film the Sensorites, Verity Lambert put her foot down that she wanted to get the show out of Lime Grove Studio D, which was basically the worst tool shed imaginable to try and film in.
It was the tiniest studio they had on set.
So eventually she got Sidney Newman to go through, and Newman wrote a ultimatum to the chief of programs, Donald Baverstock, saying if Doctor Who did not get better facilities, the whole show should just be canceled. And
oh, wow. They doubled or nothinged it.
They basically got in a game of chicken with the head of production.
Wow.
So eventually this paid off, and eventually they got Riverside Studio One. Not for this serial, later on.
For season two, I think.
Yes. Part of the problem with this one is why it feels that the spaceship things dragged on a little too long is they tried to get as much as they could in the spaceship because size and everything. They had to completely deconstruct that set for when they filmed the Sensorite Planet.
Okay. All right.
So they couldn't have both sets at the same time.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you normally just like film things out of sequence then?
Well, but they didn't have the time to do that. They were basically
They didn't do that back then. They were basically filming
in order. Yeah, that's also why editing was, you know, such a tight thing, which we discussed in the Aztecs. They were basically filming everything right up to the point of release. So,
oh my goodness.
And they edited live.
Yeah.
What?
They had a multi-camera setup and they would cut
Are kidding me.
No.
Are kidding me. Oh my gosh.
Almost all the editing was done live.
It looks like this and they did it live?
Yeah.
I mean, they still had outtakes and stuff.
They had 3 or 4 post-production edits they could do per episode.
Right. Well, I mean, and I took a film editing, I took a film class or whatever. We learned about live editing and we actually did a ball game together. You know, I've done that before, but like to have something that polished that's mostly edited live is very impressive.
I once in college, I was a film student for my bachelor's and I did a live session directed, and the professor was honestly afraid I was going to vomit at the halfway point. I apparently went completely white. It is a stressful job.
Well, I mean, it's not stressful if you're super practiced at it.
Yeah.
If you're doing a ball game, but like there's only so many shots that you take at a ball game. I mean, you have 3 cameras, one in the middle, one on either side doing the hero shots. And then you have one extra person just doing like crowd. This would be like filming a theater performance basically then.
That's basically what they were doing. Yeah.
Oh my God.
And again, they were doing it without a zoom function on the camera. So in order to push in, they had to literally push in.
Oh my gosh. That makes some of those shots in the Aztecs much more impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was very impressed when I went back and did the memes for that episode at the variety of points of view.
Yeah. Especially I remember the final fight between Ixta and Ian when Ian chucks him over the, what are they called? Those Aztec pyramid things. Do they have a special name?
It's just a pyramid.
Just a pyramid. He chucks him off and we get like a distance shot, as I recall. We get a wide, which they're clearly like doing some model work there. And that is an impressive thing to do, even without doing it live.
Yeah. Wow. I'm very impressed now.
Speaking of impressive shots and bringing it back to the Sensorites, we have, even in New Who, a very rare thing, but especially in Classic Who, a almost continuous pan. There is a sneaky cut here or there, but a continuous pan from the inside of the TARDIS to the spacecraft.
Yeah.
That did look really nice, and Josh noticed it.
I did. Yeah. I was very impressed. I didn't know they could do that.
This is the only time in Classic Who, and it's not been done that much in Modern Who, because it's a lot of faff for
one shot.
Right.
Especially when, you know, you can just cut from an interior to an exterior and get the same effect.
Well, but they pulled it off really well for...
Yeah, well,
it looked great.
Knowing now that they went into this kind of worrying they would get canceled, that opening where they're kind of reminiscing about all the stuff that came up, it does have a very finale feel.
Yeah.
Ironically, it won't even be the season finale, but we'll get to that.
Well, it was at one point going to be the season finale.
Oh.
So what was going to, it was going to be the closing story of the first season, but because they finally got renewed for a second season during production, Baverstock decided that they would only have a 4-week hiatus. So they filmed The Reign of Terror, and instead of being the opener of season two, it became the new season one finale.
Oh. Well, we'll have to see how that one turns out.
Something, just a minor tidbit that's not really important. The third episode of the serial, Hidden Danger, was the first Doctor Who episode to be delayed because of BBC sports programming.
Huh.
Wimbledon really? Ran long.
Oh, sure. Wow, people care about tennis?
I've got to say, though, that feels really, knowing that the first episode ran when BBC One was showing the news about the Kennedy assassination. Like, that didn't stop the broadcast. But Wimbledon, that, I don't know. Well, we got
to
move
it. To be fair, it wasn't their president.
Even so.
I mean, would we stop something for if the prime minister got assassinated?
Probably.
No, and most people probably don't even know who that is.
Yeah.
I know who that is.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean,
I think
you're a huge
friends
nerd.
With me.
This year, I think actually people do know who it is because Boris Johnson has been part of the giant clusterfuck of COVID-19.
I mean,
that's
I wouldn't brag about that, mister. I didn't know molybdenum was a real metal. Just saying.
Yeah, you aren't living that down, Josh.
We tease because we love.
Before we continue, I have a few things I want to show Kari. That Zach showed me first. Let me see if I can just pull them out here. Boop-a-doop. Before we get to the video, which you really have to see, did you know that there are Sensorite action figures?
No.
There are.
Oh, dear. Yes.
The real sad thing here is that this action figure I'm about to show you, I'm pretty sure is more intimidating than like what was in the show.
Literally anything is more intimidating than what was in the show. An old sock is more intimidating than what was in the show. They wear footy pajamas. I can't take you seriously as an enemy if you wear footy pajamas.
So there's,
oh my god, it's adorable. Oh my god, it's even cuter than the real one. And he has the little, is that the little whisk?
He does. He has a little whisk.
Oh my god, that's the whisk. Hey, it's the security guy. I recognize him because of the bands on his. Why don't humans do that? Why don't humans have like different outfits? Then I could tell us apart. Mm. It would be so nice. Oh my gosh. It's adorable though. That's super cute.
That one's hyper detailed.
And here's another one. This one's a little earlier.
That one came out a little small, unfortunately.
Yes, well, look, they don't really... Very few of these were made, and not the best pictures were taken of them.
For those of you listening, I will leave links to all of the pictures in the more info down below. I'm worried I peaked early because I have a video that I need to show her.
Do you want her to calm down first?
I think I do. I'm not sure how I can like.
Okay, I'm okay. You guys, okay.
Are you okay?
You think you'd be used to Sensorites by now?
I didn't even show her the one with the baby blue onesie. I don't know what's.
I'm okay.
All right.
I think
now,
I'm okay.
Now, Kari, more than that, as we know, before there was streaming and box sets and all of this stuff, DVDs and VHS were probably the primary way people would have watched these old serials.
Yeah.
Would you like to see how the BBC marketed this particular serial for the DVD release?
Yes.
I have sent you a link to the commercial.
We'll link this too.
Yeah, I'll be putting all links in the thing. They take it so seriously. It's like they're building up how terrifying these things are.
They're selling a different story.
They really are. I'm kind of disappointed that we can't end the season here. We have to go to Reign of Terror because this...
Yes. I
don't think we're going to get a better reaction out of Kari from any... Yes.
I think we may just end here. I think we'll try and recover Kari by the next episode you guys.
So hopefully we'll have her resuscitated by the time we come back. Until then, this is the Daleks Aren't Robots team reminding you to always feed your TARDIS. Keep your sensorites out of the dark, because they don't like that. And
we'll see you for the Reign of Terror.
Yep, the Reign.
And meeting Robespierre. Anyway, see you guys then.
Yep. Good night.
You have only proved that you can lock doors. We can unlock them.